A very good afternoon, Namibia. You are now tuned into Eagle FM, and I'm your staffer, Happy Juju, keeping you informed up until 14:30. It's Thursday, the 16th of October, 2025, and we are moving steadily through the week, reflecting, regrouping, and staying in step with the stories shaping our nation. Now, Thursday is all about momentum, carrying the energy of the week forward and setting the stage for what's next. You're currently tuned into On the Radar News Analysis, the program where we take a closer look at Namibia's top stories, unpacking the headlines, the developments, and the context behind them. So join in on the conversation by sharing your views on Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, or WhatsApp, and ensure that you listen to us via Eagle FM app or Eagle FM website. Your voice matters, and it shapes the national dialogue. Now, whether you're listening from the red sands of Kalahari, the misty shores of Swakopmund, the quiet hills of Opuwo, the open plains of Mahikeng, or right here in the heart of Windhoek, thank you for choosing Eagle FM as your trusted source of news and insight. Stay tuned for more news and unpacked stories making headlines. Let's get right into the headlines. The governor of Kabago East, Julius Mbayuka, in collaboration with the Development Bank of Namibia, DBN, and Agribank, today announced three beneficiaries of the National Youth Development Fund in the region. The successful recipients are Kwatambunga Fish Investment CC for Fish Shop, Paskake Investment CC Renewable Energy, and Malahanga Investment CC Bricklay. Governor Mbayuka urged the beneficiaries to use the funds responsibly and maintain transparent financial records, cautioning that any misuse could erode public trust and jeopardize future youth development initiatives. He commended DBN and Agribank for their ongoing commitment to empowering young entrepreneurs, citing Agribank's Agri Pioneer Scheme as key examples of youth-orientated financing. Now, according to officials, the Kabango East region received a total of 1,375 applications for the National Youth Development Fund, reflecting growing youth interest in entrepreneurship and economic participation. Let's now take a listen to Governor of Kabango East Region, that is Julius Mbayuka.
This youth fund, each of you must be diligently and honestly in managing the funds you receive. Use them strictly for the business activities you proposed. Keep clear records, honor and repayment schedules, and seek help earlier if challenges arise. Misuse or waste of these resources would betray public trust, slow down our development effort, and ultimately harm the scores of youth of Namibia. Thankful our financial partners and aligned with this value. DBN, for example, explicitly sees youth financing as part of its mandate to develop the national economy by financing sustainable enterprises and help reduce youth unemployment. Agribank, too, has developed a special Agri-Pioneers scheme aimed squarely at young farmers. This is an affordable financing facilities with relaxed terms and conditions designed for the youth. Such program exists to support exactly the kinds of enterprises you are building. I encourage you to take advantage of these bank offerings and to keep in close contact with Agribank and DBN officials. This youth fund is not a handout. It is a partnership between the government, the banking institution, and you, the beneficiaries. In the best case scenario, the businesses you create will repay the loans and grow, create more jobs, thereby resolving the money back into the system for future entrepreneurs. As Finance Minister Honorable Erica Shafuda noted, the fund's capital is intended to empower the youth to initiate, sustain, and expand business ventures across multi-sectoral of the economy It is expected to drive sustained growth by supporting youth-led business that enhance productivity, innovation, and GDP. In other words, your success is our shared success and a testament to the vision behind these initiatives. I want to assure you that the Kavango East Regional Leadership will keep a close eye on progress. My office will follow up on the funded projects in our region, and you will be asked to report on key milestones. At the same time, we are committed to helping remove any obstacles in your path. Today's forum is only the beginning. Use it well. Ask questions of Agribanks and DBN representatives and raise any concern about implementation or support you need. We have arranged for specialists here to clarify technical issues, and our regional staff will work with you afterwards. If problems arise, bring them forward. The Youth Fund is meant to be a living program. One way your inputs helps improve the system for everyone. Indeed, the government has established a youth-led monitoring framework for exactly this reason, to ensure transparency and accountability as the fund expands. In conclusion, let me express my confidence in you. The trust placed in your ideas will only be justified by your hard work, creativity, and integrity. We, the government, and our partners are committed to supporting you every step of the way. As governor of Kavango East Region, I pledge to do my utmost to see these projects through and to celebrate your success. The road ahead will not always be easy. Entrepreneurship is a challenging, but you have the backing of the whole region and the full resources of this fund at your disposal. Once again, welcome to this meeting. I thank the representative from Agribank, Master Desker.
Let's now take a listen to Agribank representative also speaking at the beneficiary announcement.
To empower farmers from the youth up to the aged, so we do not segregate, we give everybody as long as we've got the passion of producing or farming. So in this case, when this initiative was brought from the government, Agribank also become part of the initiative to be responsible in also helping the, especially the youth, so that they can also be included. Normally what happened, because it's a pilot project, the application was brought to the office of the governor. Then after assessment, they were sent to Rendo in our head office. Now in the head office, there's a committee which has been set. And then they also check the requirement, aligning with our requirement, which we are using. So as a result, the selection was done. And then as a pilot, supposed to select one, we start with such a beneficiary. And then Esther was one of the beneficiaries in Kavango East, and then we have Kativa that is in Kavango West. So she was asking when is she going to receive it.
Save and win at WB in the Pick a Box birthday promo. Enter today with your Smart Buy card. Get a 2 kg bag of nice rice for just $34.99. 750ml quality select cooking oil for just $29.99. 100ml Aquafresh toothpaste for just $16.99. And 1kg Sunlight hand wash powder, now only $29.99. Learn more about Pick a Box at www.vurmanbrock.com. T's and C's apply. We care.
We resume.
To empower farmers, education has been received. It was sent to the branch from head office, specifically in our office, and our business consultant, Mr. Daskin Darisa, is responsible in compiling the submission. So after compiling the submission, that's the process, then it's sent to our accreditee for check and balance. Then after that, it's approved. Once it's approved, we've been trying to call the client. Unfortunately, we could not get hold of her, but we got the number now, and also we alerted her that we're going to call her. So we'll call her, so she'll sign the agreement. From there, after signing the agreement, then the money is going to be dispersed according to the quotation which has given where she's buying the material. So that's where we are. So the encouragement is that when the money has been given to you, it's not something which is for you alone. Remember, you are representing others, and also you are trying to create job opportunity for others. And also, as a pilot, others, they must also contribute, so that when they come, they also, they have the reference that our sister who also benefited is also doing well. It was the report to be and then from that there, which I need to add also that time, I can do the problem, and then we'll be able to sort out the problem to help you. So to push themselves, it's not only the aged, but we want our youth to work hard, to till the land, and also to employ others, and to cross the border so that we are able to utilize our own product within the country, in the region, and also within the country. I think in short, unless there's any question, but in short, this is the presentation, especially the priority to our beneficiary. So she should not be worried that maybe she won't get her money or whatever she applied for, she will really receive. Thank you. Before I close, I will ask my colleague if there's anything which he can add so that we can be
clear. Thank you very much. As the Prime Minister says, I just want to take you through the process flow. What will happen in stage one, it's where the client or the beneficiary will submit the application. At this stage, the application is submitted to the governor's office. And then stage two is where we do the assessment. And then stage three, it's where we do the approval and the contract signing. And then we'll have stage four, where we'll do the disbursement. And then now we have the last stage where we'll do the business support and training and the mentorship. So for the beneficiary, they should not worry. The bank will take off you, will make sure that you receive training, whatever you applied for. As Kativa, as I've said earlier, the company's name is Kwatambange Fish Investment. She will be selling fish. So the bank will be able to finance the capital, the working capital, and also provide the fridge, the solar, and the water tank for her to, in order for her to manage to run her business. And she also indicated that to employ other fellow youth to support In short, I just wanted to give more details on the loans that our beneficiary applied. Thank you.
Good. Thank you. That's the presentation. Let me then open if there are any questions. I said earlier I was trying to move the
And our representative from the Development Bank of Namibia explaining how they selected the beneficiaries of the National Youth Development Fund.
As the director, So after we received the application forms, we then had to do an assessment. So we did assessment of these application forms at our regional offices, where we had to, where we identified the beneficiaries that we are being granted. So now it has divided in three parts. The Rural Bank of Namibia will then deal with enterprise-related applications, and then AgriBank will deal with agriculture-related applications, and then the Environmental Fund had to deal with eco-friendly application forms. So for BBN, through our assessment, in Kabango East, we identified the first time of meeting the gentleman, Malangahi Investment, which is a big making project. So after the application forms, the developmental impact that they will create three permanent jobs within their structure, and they will also make affordable bricks that they can sell to different clients, the community members. And what we saw is like it's a project that is already ongoing, and they are already servicing different clients. So they needed funding to expand their business operation, and hence the approval. So now going forward, before disbursements or payments are given to them, so we are at the stage where we are now drafting approval letters. So as soon as the approval letters are done, then you call them in to consign those loan agreements. Okay? So those loan agreements basically will then state what are the terms and conditions of these loans, what are the payment periods, what are the interests, so they understand from the onset as to what agreement are they going to. So if there are questions as to when will they receive the money or the material equipment, so that will happen after we have now signed the loan agreement with the respective beneficiaries. I hope I made that clear. So I think in a nutshell, I think that's what I can say for now. Maybe the next part is the application.
And with that, we pause right here now and take a trip to the marketplace. But don't go anywhere. We have yet more coming your way. Stay tuned.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of failure.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
Not fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You're the person who doesn't have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in parliament, let me not take up my Katatura manners.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to
be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before. It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past, and it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye.
Welcome back. Namibia is marking the 25th silver anniversary of the United Nations Security Council Resolution 1325 on Women, Peace and Security under the theme 25 Years of 1325, Honoring the Legacy, Advancing the Women, Peace and Security Agenda. The commemoration highlights Namibia's continued commitment to advancing women's participation in peace building, security and leadership across Africa. Joining the event is the Minister. But before we get to the minister, let's take a listen to. Let's now take a listen to Imbarata Mulamula.
This year, as you have said, marks this silver jubilee, but we are also celebrating the Beijing plus 30. What a year! What a moment. I must say, the international community, 25 years ago, committed itself and affirmed that women had long known and lived that peace is more sustainable, more just, and more inclusive when women are fully engaged at every level of decision making, from conflict prevention to post-conflict reconstruction, excellencies. And yet, today, materialism, of course, materialism is challenged, and nowhere is this more visible than in the growing number of protracted conflicts and emerging threats we face, from Sudan to the Great Lakes region, in the Sahel, now in Madagascar, in the Gaza, in Europe, there is existential threat of emerging conflicts, of recurring conflicts, but then we are also being faced with the new threats to security brought about by climate change that now intersects with the and amplifies conflict, displacing communities, drying up livelihoods, and exacerbating tensions, especially for rural and indigenous women. Excellencies, we cannot ignore this overlapping crisis, but neither we can afford to sideline gender equality in our response. Women are not merely victims of this crisis. They are architects of peace. And this has been said, and was also well put by my sister from SADC, that we call for the full, equal, meaningful, and safe participation of women in peace processes across all mediation tracks, formal and informal, and throughout post-conflict recovery and constructions. We, as women, we need a strong focus on women's inclusion and protection, as well as full respect for international humanitarian and human rights law, which must be integrated throughout the work of the UN, African Union, and other multilateral institutions in all peace operations. Let me also emphasize, accountability must also remain at the core of our agenda. We underline the crucial role of justice, and we have the justice here, Chief Justice, His Lordship. I'm calling that we should end impunity of perpetrators and delivering meaningful redress for victims, particularly in cases of conflict-related sexual and gender-based violence. Your Lordship, peace without justice is not peace, it's only silence. Excellencies, as the newly appointed envoy, shouldering this enormous responsibility on women, peace and security, and of course riding on the shoulders of my predecessor, who knew very well, Madam Binetta Diop, I pledge to serve as a bridge between institutions and communities, between policy and practice, and between our aspirations and our actions. However, let me say, Excellencies, I cannot fulfill this responsibility without your support and collaboration. The legacy of UN Security Council Resolution 1325 is not measured by the number of meetings we have, by the number of workshops we hold, by the number of resolutions we pass, but by the number of lives we change. Let this silver anniversary be not a commemoration of promises made, but a renewal of promises kept. Because when women lead, peace is not just possible, it is powerful, it is lasting, and it is real. I thank you very much.
President Netumbo Nandi-Ndaitwah delivered the keynote address at the event, which featured the participation of three former female heads of state. Now, the commemoration brings together African leaders, civil society representatives, youth, and international partners to reflect on Africa's pioneering role in advancing women's full and equal participation in peace-building and decision-making processes. Let's take a listen to her.
On the protocol established by our director of ceremonies, and to recognize our women in uniform, particularly those who participated in the UN and AU peacekeeping operations, and to say, ladies and gentlemen, and all of you, you are really recognized in your different capacities. As we gather here today to celebrate the silver anniversary landmark of the United Nations Security Council Resolution 1325 on women, peace and security, it is with delight that I welcome you all to the Republic of Namibia, the land of the brave. In my capacity as the fifth president of the Republic of Namibia. Yes, this is the first time that Namibia is having a female president. And as we know it in Namibia, women do not need to be invited to the table. Women have just to be given a space in order to play their role in the table for leadership. Allow me, therefore, at the onset to thank the AU Commission for having worked with us in organizing this celebration. Namibia is grateful to the African Union Commission for the partnership and active collaboration in making this historical event possible. Our continental organization has continued to guide Africa towards a future that is just, peaceful, and prosperous. Under the leadership of the African Union's vision towards Agenda 2063, we are reminded that our continent's strength lies in unity, in shared responsibility, and in the pursuit for peace and development that leaves no one behind. That simply means both men and women have to participate in peace process as they participate in the development of our continent. We also thank the SADC Secretariat for joining us. This partnership and support is a clear reflection of the importance that the regional leadership plays in advancing the women peace and security agenda. This is not only through standard setting and regional coordination, but also by ensuring that regional voices remain at the forefront of the global action and, more importantly, implementation. Statements made, document drawn up, policies developed without implementation is just as good as they do not exist. I also extend our heartfelt welcome to our distinguished former heads of state who join us today. The former president of Liberia, the former president of the Central African Republic, the former president of the Ethiopia, and our former deputy president of South Africa. You are the pioneering women who have broken the barriers, and we should not forget that at any time in our history. As the first president of the Republic of Namibia, a female, I proudly stand on your shoulders. your courage, leadership, and tenacity continues to inspire me and generations of women and girls across Africa and the world. And I must really tell you that your presence at this gathering today has added to my aspiration, has given me power, has given me further strength, and is an assurance that I am not alone. You are there to support me throughout, because gender barriers are still there. You can reach, but it will not always be easy. However, with your presence, I'm assured that I'll be able to lead the people of Namibia to prosperity. During my campaign, the popular question I was always getting was, what do I say about Madam Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, and whether I know her or not? It was an easy answer for me. Of course, I said, we are born apart, one in Southern Africa, one in West Africa, and we never worked together, except when I was Africa chief negotiator for the Beijing Platform of Action, and at the time, she was in charge of the UNDP African desk. And when we were stranded for the space to do our negotiation, she was always making space available to us. The only thing I can say we have in common, we share a birth date, which is the 29 October. The year is not needed for today. Director of ceremonies, you see where I got all my inspiration. The UN Security Council Resolution 1325 is driven from the Beijing Platform of Action, a document that I also had an honor to serve as the Rapporteur General of that conference. Specifically from the critical area of concern, women in conflict. The resolution speaks to the conflict in our region that have portioned women as victims, despite the significant role they can play in changing the dynamics of the conflict. Therefore, at the heart of this jubilee, we are reminded why this resolution matters. Our Minister of International Relations and Trade has also elaborated on that, as well as all those who spoke before me. This resolution seeks inclusive and lasting peace within our communities. The African continent has experienced its fair share of conflict. Hence, Africa is taking a leading role in the implementation of the Women, Peace and Security Agenda, demonstrating the continent's commitment to inclusive peace and security. Unfortunately, 25 years later, we mark this anniversary in the context of heightened global tension and a geopolitical order that continue to see women bearing the brunt of some of the most gruesome conflict across the world. Conflict disrupts every layer of human life, families, communities, economies, and the future. It therefore demands resolutions that draw upon the wisdom, perspective, and participation of all members of our society. Namibia's leadership on women, peace, and security agenda did not begin in 2000. The principle of resolution 1325 resonates deeply with our history and lived experience. Namibian women have long been active agenda of peace, security, and liberation. From the earliest resistance to colonial rule to the liberation struggle that culminated into our independence in 1990, women have stood shoulder to shoulder with men in the pursuit of justice and freedom and on the negotiation table. Personally, and other women in Namibia, the likes of our Dr. Libertina Madila, well-known medical doctor, were part of the SWAPO negotiation team on the implementation of the UN Security Council resolution on independence.
The 25th anniversary of the United Nations Security Council Resolution 1325 on women, peace and security is a significant milestone, and Namibia is marking this occasion with a series of events. Now, this resolution emphasizes the importance of women's participation in peace building, conflict resolution and security processes. Now, the UN Security Council Resolution 1325 on women, peace and security encourages certain aspects, and the key aspects of one of them being it encourages women's involvement in peace negotiations, conflict resolution and decision making processes, as well as calls for the protection of women's rights and safety during conflicts, and aims to prevent violence against women and girls in conflict situations. It also focuses on addressing the specific needs of women and girls in post-conflict situations. The significance of this is that it recognizes the critical role that women play in promoting peace and security, as well as encourages member states to adopt gender-sensitive policies and practices that, of course, are beneficial to women, children, and girls. Now, it provides a framework for promoting women's rights and empowerment in conflict-affected areas. Namibia's commitment has been a strong advocate for the women, peace, and security agenda. Our country has taken steps to implement the UN Security Council Resolution 1325, including developing a national action plan. Namibia's leadership in promoting women's participation in peace building and security is evident in its commitment to advancing the women, peace and security agenda. Namibia has been a trailblazer in promoting women's participation in peace building and security processes. Now, the country has played a pivotal role in the adoption of the United Nations Security Council Resolution 1325 on women, peace and security in 2000 during its presidency of the UN Security Council. Of course, this resolution emphasizes the importance of women's involvement in conflict prevention, in resolution and in peace building processes. One of the key achievements is that Namibia has been the first African country to adopt a national action plan. Namibia was the first African country to develop this plan, demonstrating its commitment or our commitment to implementing the resolution's provisions. Namibia has launched the Namibia International Women Peace Center in 2020, which serves as a hub for promoting women's leadership and participation in peace building and security process. And as you had, the president also pointed out that our beloved Dr. Libertina has been one of those who has been at the signing table of the Security Council. Namibia has made significant strides in promoting women's representative in politics, with 47% of parliamentary seats held by women. That is thanks to a gender quota introduced by the party. Now, the NIWPC focuses on advocacy, on networking, on partnership building, and capacity building in order to help advance the women, peace and security agenda. Of course, it has not been without its challenges. Now, while Namibia has made progress in promoting women's participation in peace building and security, challenges do persist, such as implementing the Women, Peace and Security Agenda requires sustainable resources and commitment, of which there is currently limited resources, as well as cultural and social barriers, addressing cultural and social norms that perpetuate gender inequality and limit women's participation in decision-making processes still exist. Overall, though, Namibia's commitment to promoting women's participation in peace building and security processes serves as a model for other countries in the region, with continued efforts to address challenges and to strengthen implementation being crucial to achieving lasting peace and security. And with that, we pause here now and take a trip to the marketplace. We'll be back with more right here on the Radar News Analysis. Stay tuned.
Goeie nuus, Imba het nou nog beter geword. Ons het splinternuwe funksies bygevoeg om jou ervaring vinniger, beter en kragtiger te maak as ooit tevore. Is jy gereed om die volle potensiaal van Imba te geniet? Kry alle eksklusiewe funksies vir slegs $36 per maand of spaar selfs meer met ons spesiale intekenplanne. 5% afslag vir 'n 3 maande intekening, 10% afslag vir 'n 6 maande intekening en 25% afslag vir 'n 12 maande intekening. Kies die beste plan vir jou werk en geniet al die voordele wat Imba bied teen 'n onverbeterlike prys. Imba, waar die wêreld saamkom, laai dit af en teken vandag aan.
Listen to Eagle FM in Lodrits at 91.2 FM. Listen to Eagle FM in Omthea at 90.5. Listen to Eagle FM in Mariental at 101.2. Listen to Eagle FM in Okahanja at 104.0.
Welcome back. Now at this juncture, we tell you what's making headlines in terms of economic indicators and trading economics. Now, $1 today is equals to 17 Namibian dollars and 32 cents. €1 is equals to 20 Namibian dollars and 18 cents. £1 sterling is equals to 23 Namibian dollars and 25 cents. And $1 is equals to 11 Namibian dollars and 27 cents. £1 is equals to 21 Namibian dollars and 71 cents, while £1 is equals to 1 Namibian dollar and 30 cents. Now moving over to trading economics. South Africa's building planes slide for the third consecutive month. Now the value of building planes approved in South Africa fell 8.8% year on year to 8,097 million rands in August 2025. That is following a revised 5.3% drop in the prior month. Now marking the third consecutive monthly decline, the slump was driven primarily by additions and alterations at minus 22.0% versus 2.4% in July, while the non-residential segment continued to contract at minus 10.5% versus minus 25.2%. Elsewhere, residential projects remained flat at 0.0% versus 2.5%. European stocks advanced on Thursday, recovering from a muted open with both the stock of 50 and stock exchange of 600 up nearly 0.4%, extending the previous session's gains as investors focused on a new wave of corporate results. Nestle surged 8.5% after reporting 3.3% organic sales growth for the first 9 months of 2025 and announcing plans to cut 16,000 jobs. Sartorius jumped 10% after raising its guidance, while Pernod Ricard gained 2.1% despite posting a 7.6% decline in organic sales. The euro rose to 1.165 US dollars, moving further away from the 2-month low of 1.154 on Thursday. After France's government survived a non-confidence vote, Prime Minister Sébastien Lecornu's pledge to suspend a landmark pension reform secured support from some left-wing lawmakers. Meanwhile, US dollar came under pressure after Fed Chair Jerome Powell highlighted labor market weakness and Wednesday's Fed Boeing book confirmed further slowing in the U.S. economy, reinforcing expectations of another rate cut this month. Italy's trade surplus expanded to 2.0 billion euros in August 2025 from 1.3 billion euros in the same month last year. But it was below expectations of 7.55 billion euros, with exports falling less than imports. Exports decreased by 1.1% year on year to 38.7 billion euros due to lower sales to non-EU markets at minus 7.0%, which offset the increase in shipments to the European Union at plus 5.4%. Now, the main sectors dragging down exports were machinery and equipment at minus 5.6%, sporting goods, games, musical instruments, precious metals, medical instruments and other products at minus 19.8%. Meanwhile, the top currency gainers are New Zealand dollar at 0.44%, South Korean at 0.27%, Norwegian koren at 0.27%, British pound at 0.26%, and euro at 0.10%. The biggest losers are Japanese yen at minus 0.13% and the dollar index at minus 0.21%. The annual consumer price inflation in Italy stood at 1.6% in September 2025, that it's unchanged from the previous month and confirming preliminary estimates. It remained the lowest leading since May, as prices eased for transport-related services at 2.4% versus 3.5% in August and unprocessed food at 4.8% versus 5.6%. Meanwhile, costs increased at a faster pace for regulated energy products at 13.9% versus 12.9%, while deflation moderated for unregulated energy products at minus 5.2% versus minus 6.3%. And with that, we pause here now and take a trip to the marketplace. We'll be back shortly with more to continue. Our studio line is also open. Should you be interested in partaking and being part of the news analysis, 083-288-401 is the number in studio.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
Not fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person that doesn't have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in parliament, let me not take up my Katatura menace.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to
be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before.
Mm.
It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past.
Mm.
And it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the Eye. Listen to Eagle FM in Ludritz at 91.2 FM. Listen to Eagle FM in
South Africa
at 90.5. Listen to Eagle FM in Mariental at 101.2. Listen to Eagle FM in Okahanja at 104.0.
Welcome back, and now for news beyond the borders of Namibia, starting off regionally, then moving over to continental news, thereafter international news. We're starting off in South Africa, as South Africa is hosting the 6th PASA International Payments Conference 2025.
Africa is currently hosting the 6th PASA International Payments Conference at the Sandton Convention Center. It'll run for the next 2 days. The gathering will see more than 780 delegates and 70 local and international speakers to discuss important topics affecting the future of payments, including updates to the national payment system and the shift towards digital transactions. Watching the story is SABC News economics reporter Katlego Lehodi, who joins us now live from Sandton. And it's an important gathering for a country like South Africa, Katlego, given just how many transactions, even from the government to its people, are affected on a monthly basis. You know, the social welfare system and SASSA, for example, come to mind.
Uh,
Most definitely. A very good morning to you, Ayanda, and to our viewers at home. You're quite right. I mean, this would see a very high level of conversations already taking place here, coming through at a time when various of these countries, including us as South Africa, are taking stock of our economy and how we see developments within the economy and movements in terms of payments. So here we see various of those players also just talking and looking at the geopolitics and how we see the payments infrastructure just navigating some of these headwinds. Already we have some of those role players, even from government, just coming through. They'll be here for the coming 2 days, Ayanda, to look at developments and to try by all means to just come through with synergy in terms of solutions that can help here in navigating the payment infrastructure and the payment bottlenecks. This coming through at a time, Ayanda, you know very well that we are hosting a G20 as a country, and we see conversations also, you know, surrounding that. We're looking at the global shifts in terms of the geopolitics, and we see those conversations already taking place. And actually, in a moment, I'm going to be bringing Professor Adrian Servo, coming from Gibbs, who'll just give us and reflect with us from a panel that he was part of, where they were talking about and looking at the geopolitical shifts, Ayanda, and how as South Africa we can navigate and push through looking at all of these developments. Let me bring him into the conversation, Prof Servo, who'll just give us a sense and reflect with us, looking at the importance of the moment that we find ourselves in, but also navigating some of these challenges that are beyond us, outside of our control. And we see role players in their numbers gathering today. You've just come out of that panel discussion. Let's just reflect on the importance of the moment, but also a key takeaways from that panel that you were part of. Welcome to the SABC.
Thank you. It's great to be with you. I think one of the big messages that came out of the conversation with Justice Malala as part of this PIPC 2025 panel is the key role or the key impact that geopolitics has. Now more than ever, we find ourselves in quite extraordinary times. If you look at the political change that has happened almost country after country sequentially over the last 18 months, there's spectacular political change. And that sets a new tone and a new context for business. And inside of their business, one of the key elements to achieve inclusive, elevated economic growth, which is part of the conversation we were having at the start of this conference, it's about the pivotal role that financial inclusion plays. And so how do we how do we architect and engineer that type of infrastructure?
I mean, looking at where we find ourselves, South Africa has a vast inequality. And if you are then to look at some of the challenges on the ground and even access to some of these payment infrastructure and the ecosystem in a way that people are not left behind, where do we need to start? Where do we go in ensuring that there is equality in playing in this economy?
So there's evidence of gains that have been made recently. So increasingly, financial inclusion actually isn't about bricks and mortar, it's about data. And if you look at what's happened under Operation Vulindlela, you've seen the cost of data falling in an impressive way, in a meaningful way. And so that's at least one avenue, one channel in which financial inclusion is facilitated. Payments are made easier. A second is in conversation in the panel is the importance of financial literacy. All well and good to talk about bank accounts, but if people are financially illiterate but have bank accounts, that can hardly be what financial inclusion is about. And then in a country that can build an increasingly elevated savings platform, that's the stuff that feeds investment, and that gets the flywheel of growth going. And through that, you have the seeds of employment, productivity, and that gives birth to the redress of inequality.
And let's also just look at innovation and technology, because that becomes very important if we are looking at developing and looking at ensuring that we are prudent as an economy in South Africa. How do we ensure that we leverage on technology and we ensure as well that no one is left behind in capitalizing on really how the world is moving right now?
Well, you know, look no further than the room behind you, where you've got 700 people at this conference, evidencing, demonstrating the incredible capability and the fast changes, impressive changes that are being made in the financial industry and payments in particular. And it would be remiss not to mention in passing that the Nobel Prize this week is announced and goes to three economists working in the field of innovation. So your point is absolutely, to sort of play on a pun, absolutely on the money. Innovation is central.
Yeah, and just before we let you go, Prof, we're going into the midterm budget policy statement by the finance minister, and we know very well that there have been bottlenecks in terms of policy. You know, a lot of people concerned about the economy and how we really push to ensure that we grow the economy, looking at the various interventions on the ground. What would be your expectations? How do we actually bring about conversations of a policy to ensure that we push the economy to its optimum?
Sure. My desperate plea, it's a long stated one, you know, I'll state it again, and whether it was, you know, the budget or midterm, is really, that's sort of an academic conversation. What we really need to see in South Africa's spending pattern is the displacement of current spending with capital spending, and that we restore the economy to, a position of robust network industries, and those network industries are transport, other utilities, electricity, water, and of course, you know, here again, financial services. Those network industries are the lifeblood of a modern economy.
All right, Prof. Seville, thank you very much, sir, for giving us your time on the SABC this morning. Professor Adrian Seville coming through from Gibbs, and you hear him reflecting with us already, Ayanda, high-level conversations, discussions taking place. This would be 2 days of these conversations, and coming through at a time as we see a whole lot of these people talking about ensuring that these conversations are not lost. They move into the G20 summit in the coming month. Ayanda, back to you.
Now, this PASA conference gathers more than 780 delegates and 70 local and international speakers in order to discuss important topics affecting the future of payments, including updates to the national payment system and the shift toward digital transactions. Still in South Africa, now we're talking about the presidency of South Africa, that is 628 million rands paid for Zuma's legal fees. Let's take a listen.
Of the presidency and the state attorney are facing off today with former President Jacob Zuma and others. Now, it's important to stress that the applicants in this matter are government departments and not individuals. This is all in a bid to try to recover 28 million rand that was apparently paid for Zuma's legal fees in his personal capacity. The DA is also involved in this case, and it seems this is their attorney currently making representations. Let's listen in.
The State Attorney's Act. But what is important to note that whilst the SEA dealt with those issues on appeal, it didn't change or alter the full court's decision. In fact, it said that the public could rely on the full court's decision, and it stands unchallenged today. Now, on the question of interest, sorry, my lord, I must just explain how we discovered the shortfall. That's important. And I will give all the credit to my learned junior, who came to see me and we sat for many days analyzing invoices, the BAS documents. It was a monumental task for us, not having been involved in either the full court or the SEA proceedings. And I say this because it's deserving. Ms. Jonker, who is here in court today, I called upon her to assist me with finding the appeal record. There were documents all over, and Mr. Ndebele and I struggled for weeks on end to put the papers together, and then when it came to the accounting, we discovered the missing 10 million rand. And it came from obvious gaps in the accounting which didn't correlate with certain proceedings. So once that was discovered, obviously it took a long time to get those documents, which apparently came from the archives, and that is with the amount of 10,699,046.62 came from. Now, on the question of interest, the notes of motion was issued without a claim for interest. By letter, Jeannie and I, in preparing the application, relied heavily on the constitutional imperatives that were at hand. The two courts never expressed any question of interest, and they simply went as far as to say, to merely set aside the decisions, the various decisions of 2005, 2007, and if I recall, 2018, to set aside those and then for the state attorney then to institute action based on Mr. Zuma's undertaking to repay, that would not be doing justice to the case. That is why both courts held that the state attorney must account, must render an accurate account, together with an order for repayment. And if it wasn't for that rider, the simple task of setting aside three decisions as having been unlawful on the BA's part in terms of PAJA and on the EFF's part on the principle of legality was insufficient. So another round before court would have to steps would have to be taken in that regard. So when the fourth respondent's counter-application was filed, we considered what they alleged to have been an oversight on the part of the applicants. We took steps, when I say we, counsel, to prepare in terms of Rule 28.1, notice of amendment, to include a prayer for interest. What ensued there was a long debate whether this was a debt in the ordinary case and whether interest should follow. Ultimately, my lord, I have to tell you that my instructions were not to claim interest, because the courts had not expressed themselves specifically in that fashion. And that is why we abandoned the amendment process.
As you heard there, the Office of the Presidency of South Africa and the State Attorney is facing off with former President Jacob Zuma and others at the High Court in Pretoria. Now, the applications are the government departments and not individuals in a bid to recover approximately 28 million rands paid for Zuma's president, former South Africa's president, Jacob Zuma's legal fees in his personal capacity. Now, this comes after the decisions taken by the presidency of South Africa and the state attorney in order to cover the legal costs Zuma incurred were invalidated, reviewed and set aside. In addition, the state attorney was directed to, among others, take all the necessary steps to recover the amounts paid by the state for former president of South Africa, Jacob Zuma's legal costs. Now we move on to Zambia, where Zambia and Scotland are set to deepen a green growth cooperation.
It was a meeting of partners, Zambia and Scotland coming together to strengthen their shared vision of development and cooperation. At State House, President Hakainde Hichilema hosted the visiting First Minister of Scotland, John Swinney, where discussions focused on deepening collaboration in areas that matter most to both nations.
We are also encouraged and would like to continue our collaboration around agriculture in the context of climate change, the negative effects of climate change. And I think we do, in the side room, we're talking about enhancing cooperation with your specialist institutions that are doing research on, you know, genetics, drought-resistant crops, and early maturing, for example, and other aspects. I think disease resistance in the crop issues. And talking about that research, going back to health, I think the importance of one health, human health, animal health, is very important as we do our research. So I would like to take that forward and might work on the Green Growth Compact with the British government, of which the Scottish government is part of, the British government, to extend those aspects that are relevant to, of course, sustainable energy, renewable energy. So we want to cooperate, continue cooperation on that.
President Hichilema praised Scotland's ongoing support to Zambia in sectors such as education, health and governance, and encouraged Scottish businesses to explore investment opportunities in Zambia.
Also emphasized, First Minister, the importance of actually rolling out, interesting Scottish businesses to look into the opportunities that we have here in Zambia. For investment, so we can, I think, run that side of things as well, which supports the things we're already doing in terms of revenue generation that are mutually beneficial to the Scottish economy, to the Zambian economy. I think we would like to continue expanding, exploring areas around there of cooperation. I think overall, we are very, very delighted that you are here, very happy that you're here. And we look forward to more work going on, cooperation.
And Mr. Swinney reaffirmed Scotland's commitment to advancing ties with Zambia, highlighting key areas like gender equality, global health and inclusive education.
It is equally an innovative and forward-looking relationship that we now have with great potential for further growth, in particular focused on our work together in health, education, equalities, renewable energy and climate justice, with sustainable economic growth and well-being in Zambia our shared goal. I would like to take this opportunity again to assure you that Scotland remains wholly committed to investing in and indeed growing our deep, long-lasting and strategic relationship with Zambia.
His visit, which is part of efforts to strengthen Scotland's engagement with Africa, will also take him to Malawi before returning home. Ruth Chainda, ZNBC News, Lusaka.
The Parliamentary Committee of South Africa on Defence and the Border Management Authority is busy assessing operations at the border with Zimbabwe. Illegal immigration and the smuggling of illicit goods are the main challenges at the border. Let's take a listen.
The Parliamentary Committee on Defence and the Border Management Authority will be assessing operations at the border with Zimbabwe. Illegal immigration and the smuggling of illicit goods are the main challenges at the border. SABC News reporter Pimani Baloyi is there. Pimani, good morning. So this is an ongoing story. It's a long-standing problem. And of course, it's all good and well to have another in loco inspection of that border crossing. But I suppose most people want to know what is going to be done. You've had opportunity. I saw your interview yesterday with one of the members of parliament, Malusi Gigaba. So what are they saying? What is the plan going forward to actually address the problems at the border post?
Good morning, Sakin, and good morning to our viewers. As you rightfully stated, this is not the first oversight visit to this forest entry. And as you rightfully stated, yesterday we were able to speak to Malusi Gigaba, who is the co-chairperson of this Joint Standing Committee on Defense. And mostly what he said is, you know, Malusi has worked, Gigaba has worked as Home Affairs Minister at some point, and he spoke at length that it appears the biggest source of this problem that ensures that there is not sufficient security personnel manning this port of entry and others is the fact that there has been a cut down of the allocation, the annual allocation budget for the SANDF, stating that at the end of this, or of all of this, they're going to compile a report that will be taken to the Department of Defense, but also to Parliament and the SANDF, calling, advocating for an increase in the allocation that is given to the SANDF, the BMA and other stakeholders that work in ensuring that there is safety and security on this port of entry. But you know what, Sakina, we are currently coming to you from in front of that gate of the port of entry, and our hope was that we're going to get reaction. What do people hope Parliament would know, as Parliament is here, about, you know, challenges faced here? But on record, none of the people, you can imagine, there's a hive of economic activity, people who offer transport services, people who offer food for people who are traveling here, but also your travelers themselves, as well as long distance truck companies. All of them were able to tell us off record that, you know, they wish there could be more resources allocated here, there could be more police officers and soldiers stationed here, ensuring that, you know, there is safety, because there's a high rate of crime here. But they are aware that it seems there are challenges with resources. On record, they were unable to tell us this, but their biggest wish is that also the illegality, specifically people who work in the taxi industry, saying they have seen a decline of passengers coming to them, because passengers complain that once they get inside the port of entry, they are asked to declare if they have cash on them, and some of the cash is confiscated by authorities, calling that they are, you know, consequence management systems to ensure that people who work in the port of entry, if they do conduct corruption, there's action taken against them, and that this is kept. So the wish is that Parliament should figure out what are some of the things that are not going right here, and come up with systems that will ensure that this is kept. And we do know that Parliament will be hearing from authorities that work within that port of entry at about 9 o'clock at the Messina Municipal Council. And at the end of it, we'll be able to speak to them to gather what was their impression and what would be the way forward, Sakina.
Indeed, Pimani Baloyi, and of course, with the Border Management Authority coming in as a new entity to bring about a new dawn, so to speak, in that regard, it's going to be interesting to hear what is being said and what that particular report contains.
Meanwhile, Ethiopia's debt talks tail as bond holders weigh legal action.
Debt restructuring talks with international bondholders have now hit a deadlock, and that's due to disagreements over terms. The East African nation defaulted on its only international bond in late 2023. It has since then been negotiating under the G20's common framework, requiring equal treatment for official and commercial creditors. Now, the debt restructuring dispute between Ethiopia and its bondholders hinges on whether to reduce the principal amount, known as a haircut. Bondholders, of course, proposed a value recovery instrument to essentially recoup losses through Ethiopia's export performance. But those talks have stalled. The bondholder committee says it is now weighing legal action. The defaulted bond at the center of the negotiations fell 1 cent to the dollar following Tuesday's statements, although it still remains close to its highest price level since early 2021 at 95 cents to the dollar. Now, of course, earlier I spoke to Professor Mulatu Fekadu Zerihun. He's the head of the Economics Department at the Shwane University of Technology in South Africa. And he gave us more insight into the sticking points that led to this impasse with bondholders in Ethiopia.
The haircut of 20% is a bit rigid and a bit higher for in African context in general and in the context of Africa in particular. And again, the instrument used, the VIR, supposed to consider existing economic condition in the country. This mismatch and a lot of information asymmetry between the deal makers eventually leads to a disappointing outcome, which is not a good signal for Ethiopia and the entire African continent.
Well, it is interesting when we talk about this value recovery instrument. I mean, one of the arguments that bondholders are making is that Ethiopia's debt burden remains a liquidity issue rather than a solvency issue. So looking at Ethiopia's economic performance so far, do you agree with this assessment?
You know, the value recovery instrument, for example, now recently Ethiopia completed its Grand Renaissance Dam, which is a multi-billion project, and there are reviving economic conditions in the country, which can be signal a good indicator for the investors. However, the other party, the negotiating party, failed to understand the recovery in the economy, the good prospect in the economy, which is not really a wise decision not to recognize existing condition in the country. So, all in all, you know, when one country fails in Africa, it's a failure for the rest of the continent. Therefore, as I said before, I can see there is a lot of information asymmetry, misunderstanding and well articulation of the economy, for the last, couple of years, especially after the economic reform, homegrown economic reform in the country. There are a lot of prospects happening. Mega projects are completed. So these are good indicators, but you know, the global financial architecture always has biased view towards African countries. It's very sad news.
Well, looking ahead, we know Ethiopia's government has said that despite the lack of a deal this time around, they've still made substantial progress. Now that both sides have agreed to basically terminate those discussions without an agreement, what do you expect will happen next?
Termination is not a good alternative, you know. Still, there are room for negotiation. There are negotiation may fail and can be a successful. But, you know, losing hope and terminating the entire negotiation process, it's not a wise decision. For me, you know, there are a lot of ways to again revive the discussion, bringing facts in the ground to the table. Therefore, even though this negotiation is not successful this time, there is a prospect that narrowing the information gap between the two deal makers, I can see there is again possibility of reviving this negotiation for the best of Ethiopia and the rest of Africa.
Standard and Poor's upgrades Egypt on economic reforms and rate cut.
This ratings upgrade is the first since Egypt started receiving financial support in 2024 and the second such affirmation following last year's Fitch upgrade to B on account of rising foreign investment and tighter monetary conditions that were seen to be building stronger finances.
Consumers still the main driver for economic growth, but for Egypt, I believe that we have in our economic development, sustainable development plan for the Vision 2030, we have a very ambitious goal to enhance, exports to arrive to $145 billion.
SP says the strategic importance of Egypt has been highlighted and elevated by the conflict in Gaza, one that has been part of the reason that Gulf Cooperation Council members and other countries continue to extend financial support to Egypt.
All these, regional challenges may affect to some extent economic progress in Egypt. Like you mentioned, Suez Canal revenue that actually has been reduced significantly from approximately $11 billion into $3 billion. So this is a huge amount that we have lost during the last period.
The government is also pushing forward with the initial public offering as part of a broader plan to attract private investment and boost economic growth.
First of all, the situation of our stock market, we always been waiting for the right time, the suitable time for IPO. Another thing that we have a lot of work to be done regarding specifying the right value for our assets, so we referred in that to IFC. This is quite important so that we can have international expertise in this matter.
It also seeks to attract private investment and boost economic growth by supporting Egyptian companies who are keen to expand their footprint across Africa. One such company is the Commercial International Bank, whose forays outside North Africa saw it acquire a Kenyan lender, Mafia Bank, and is stepping up strategic investment and partnerships in cross-border trade along the Comesa corridor.
For a bank operating in North Africa, there are two corridors we are chasing for an Egyptian bank. So technically, the remittance corridor, where the money comes from the Egyptian diaspora back, is a corridor we are chasing. The trade corridor, which is to a great extent around the east side of Africa, is another corridor we are chasing. So that could give you just an idea about which countries we could be interested to be in and we will be in.
Focus has been around improving productivity and grow the purchasing power of households. And to this end, authorities in Cairo have increased the minimum wage levels twice since last year to help alleviate the impact of currency devaluation and inflation.
Inflation come down from almost 23% to hover around 12%. Central bank was extremely wise, cutting the interest rates. And that what incentivized the store's growth in CapEx investments since the beginning of this year and maybe mid of last year too.
Although the inflation expectations remain exposed to upside risks stemming from both domestic and global factors, including regulated price adjustments exceeding projections and rising geopolitical tensions in the region, the truce in Gaza offers a glimpse of hope. There is cautious optimism that a lasting peaceful resolution will be reached, diminishing the external threat to Egypt's economic reform journey. Beryl Oro, CGTN.
In other news, former DRC Congo President Kabila has been seen in Kenya weeks after being sentenced to death. Now, the former president of the Democratic Republic of Congo was seen in public on Wednesday for the first time since he was sentenced to death in absentia on charges of treason and war crimes for collaborating with rebels.
Joseph Kabila, the former president of the Democratic Republic of Congo, made his first public appearance on Wednesday after being sentenced to death in absentia.
Ondakala handu yako parateza morwe data. Paife ohandimo kuyadi. Nondaka ne data no shoyo o utungaraka vahupi. Onetwe kaimwe okufuta rumwe okuyinyenga rumwe okujapa ndali fio papa ndauka. onda pumbwa o network ayo hai dira dira ya fange o mafikwa amwe o handi streaming o mafikwa amwe o handi popi o mafikwa amwe o handi ninga ishe po shika ndo shimwe pamwe na parateza o inda holora ame ishi pangere osho pa umwene dira dira o makwata fanoni data momkaro wili mwana parika o kutuma ko utumaraka o ku streaminga no kudenga pamwe na parateza Konga, Parates, Namibia. Always prepare,
Parates. Joseph Kabila, the former president of the Democratic Republic of Congo, made his first public appearance on Wednesday after being sentenced to death in absentia on charges of treason and war crimes. During the event in Nairobi, Kenya, Kabila was seen alongside various Congolese political leaders who are in opposition to the current government. While in Nairobi, Kabila participated in a signing ceremony that established a new political movement, uniting a dozen opposition leaders. They aim to connect with all Congolese citizens who oppose the current regime in Kinshasa, with the goals of ending what they describe as a dictatorship, restoring state authority, re-establishing democracy, and promoting national reconciliation. The controversial ruling stems from allegations of Kabila's collaboration with rebel forces. The government has accused Kabila of working with Rwanda and the rebel group M23, which has recently seized control of significant cities in the conflict-ridden eastern region of Congo.
Sudan's oil production has dropped after South Sudan's secession, finance minister says.
Sudan's finance minister on Wednesday said his country's oil production dropped from 500,000 barrels a day to less than 30,000 after South Sudan gained independence from Sudan in 2011. Jibril Ibrahim spoke at the Russian Energy Week Forum in Moscow. The event brought together officials from 84 countries to discuss energy issues. Ibrahim said Sudan's oil production could go back up with support from the right partners.
Many years you've been working in the...
Before the cessation of South Sudan, the total reserves we had was something like 5 billion barrels. And we are left with only 1.5. We used to produce close to 500,000 barrels a day, and now we are producing less than 30,000 barrels a day. But we believe we can go back easily to post-cessation production of 180,000 barrels a day. That needs partners who have the technology.
Sudan's crude oil exports fell by 84% between 2000 and 2023, a trend also influenced by South Sudan's secession, according to the International Energy Agency.
Moving on to other news, President Donald Trump says that if Hamas doesn't disarm, they will disarm them.
President Trump says the United States will disarm Hamas quickly and perhaps violently, in his words, if it doesn't give up its weapons in Gaza. Mr. Trump says Hamas had told him it would disarm as part of his ceasefire deal, insisting it would happen. On Tuesday, Hamas handed over the remains of another four people. Three have been confirmed as hostages: Uriel Baruch, Tamir Nimrodi and Eitan Levy. One body is yet to be identified. Eight bodies have now been returned. Another four are expected in the next few hours. All remaining living hostages held by Hamas were returned on Monday. Israel's now reported to be reopening the Gaza border crossing with Egypt as originally scheduled. Our North America correspondent David Willis reports.
Amid Gaza's ruins lie the bodies of Israeli hostages. Hamas's failure to find them is threatening to drive an early wedge into an already fragile ceasefire agreement. The delivery of four more bodies by the International Red Cross still left 20 unaccounted for. Israel plans to restrict the delivery of aid to Gaza and keep the border crossing with Egypt closed until Hamas hands over more of the dead. Within Gaza, Hamas is reasserting its authority, turning its guns on armed clans, which it accuses of collaborating with Israel. The group's refusal to disarm poses the most immediate threat to Donald Trump's plan for peace in the region, and he was asked about it at an event at the White House.
Well, they're going to disarm, and because they said they were going to disarm. And if they don't disarm, we will disarm them.
How will you do that?
I don't have to explain that to you. But if they don't disarm, we will disarm them. They know I'm not playing games.
Many are wondering if the spirit and the celebration of the last few days can be sustained, given this is a ceasefire deal, short on detail and lacking any sort of firm agreement. Despite Donald Trump's confidence, his Israeli counterpart is striking a note of caution.
I think I heard the president speak tonight. He said, listen, they better do it, or, you know, how can I speak for him? He said, all hell breaks loose, okay? Well, I hope it doesn't. I hope we can do this peacefully, and we're certainly ready to do so.
The extent of the devastation in Gaza is said to exceed that of both Berlin and Hamburg after the Second World War. How soon the 2 million Palestinians who live there can start to rebuild their lives depends on many factors still to be worked out. David Willis, BBC News.
Our Middle East correspondent Hugo Bashega told me more about the hostage remains returned to Israel.
Three of the four bodies that were returned by Hamas to Israel last night have now been identified, but Israeli media is reporting that the authorities are saying the fourth body is not of a deceased hostage, and it's not the first time that this happens. Hamas mistakenly sent the body of a Palestinian in an exchange that happened earlier this year. So if this information is confirmed, it means that 21 bodies of hostages remain in Gaza. And obviously the delay in returning these hostages, the bodies of these deceased hostages, has caused a lot of anger in Israel, has raised fears that there could be some kind of derailment in this ceasefire deal in Gaza. And Hamas has not explained the reason behind this delay, but he had said that he didn't know the location of all those bodies inside Gaza, that it would need some time to retrieve those bodies. Obviously, under this deal, the ceasefire deal that was announced by President Trump, all those bodies must return to Israel. So obviously, for many of these families, the wait continues.
And Hugo, what is the situation with the Rafah border crossing that Israel had been keeping closed because of the situation with the return of the deceased hostages?
Yeah, so there have been reports this morning suggesting that the Rafah border crossing, which is the crossing point between Gaza and Egypt, has been reopened as planned. The Israeli authorities had threatened to delay the reopening of this border crossing because of this delay in the return of the deceased bodies, of the deceased hostages, the bodies of the deceased hostages from Gaza. And also the Israeli authorities had also threatened to restrict the entry of humanitarian aid into Gaza. Now, 600 truckloads of aid are expected to enter Gaza each day as part of this ceasefire deal. And also this morning, there have been reports in Israeli media suggesting that four more bodies of deceased hostages are expected to be returned later today.
Hugo Bashega. In Gaza, dozens of people have died in the past few days in fighting between Hamas and other armed groups. Our Gaza correspondent, Rushdie Abu Alouf, explains who these fighters are.
There is active three-four groups of gangs. They are in the north, in Khan Yunis, and also in the south, in Rafah. The biggest one, which is belong to Abu Shabab, a group. Well, these the three-four groups are located in an area where Israel is still controlling, so Hamas cannot attack them, but they are working in other elements inside. I mean, yesterday and last night, there was an exchange of fire in Shija'iyah neighborhood east of Gaza. Yesterday, the Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas issued a very long statement condemning Hamas of this public execution. They said this is a criminal activity, and it doesn't help our cause as Palestinians to show that people under occupation are executing other people in the streets of Gaza, and he urged Hamas not to do any act such as killing people in public, because this is will you know, ruin the image of Palestinians. Will Hamas justify this, saying that we can't leave Gaza for thieves and criminals and people who collaborate with Israel, and this is has no link with the future plan of who's going to govern Gaza or about the women? They said this is an immediate threat to the population, that we are trying to take it out.
We had that warning from Israel saying it would restrict aid convoys into Gaza because of the delays in returning the remaining bodies of the hostages. What is the latest in the humanitarian aid that is actually getting into the Strip at present?
Well, you know, Israel yesterday threatened to delay the opening of Rafah crossing, where we are expecting 250 people to cross into Egypt today. All of them are sick people and people who were seriously injured during the war. You know, the World Health Organization said about 15,000 people are in urgent need for treatment outside Gaza, because Gaza, you know, there is lack of facilities. Most of the hospitals are destroyed. Until now, none of the trucks crossed into Gaza, but we are expecting 400 to 600 trucks to allow today. Yesterday, Israel was also threatening to reduce the number of trucks, which is very frustrating moment for the people of Gaza. And, you know, it will take a long time for Hamas to identify the rest of the 21 Israeli hostage body in Gaza. And the ceasefire is fragile. You know, we have seen 7 people killed yesterday. So everything is grim and not clear and very frustrating for the people, that this process, which is the easiest bit, is not working according to plan.
Rushdie Abu Alouf.
Meanwhile, Putin is showing some vulnerability. That is according to former NATO official.
What is the Trump administration's strategy here, and could tomahawks exert the pressure needed to get Russia to the negotiating table? Let's bring in former NATO Deputy Secretary General Rose Gottemuller. She is joining us now live from California. Rose, it is good to see you. So President Trump is coming off of what he's described as a peace victory in Gaza, and he's using, in his words, the same model to try to bring this war in Ukraine to an end. Is that a valid analogy, in your view, that he's making? Whatever went into the actions that got to that ceasefire in Gaza can be done now in Ukraine.
He certainly had to pressure the leader of Israel, Mr. Netanyahu, to get this solution, the ceasefire in Gaza. So I think he's looking to apply some tough pressure on Vladimir Putin. The question is how best to do it. The Russians have discounted, as you just heard, the Tomahawk as being, you know, not a, a game changer in the war. On the other hand, it is a step in the direction of supplying a bigger and more capable weapon than the U.S. has supplied up to this point. So is this the way to do it? I'm not sure. There could be other inducements that the president may try on Vladimir Putin, such as opening up more economic opportunities. Those kinds of things have been very attractive to Putin in the past. So I don't think it's going to be a kind of unilayered response.
Economic opportunities, you mean sort of a carrot approach, that you stop this war and we can have further economic ties after the fact, or in the interim as well?
No, I don't want to say in the interim. I do think that it would be a carrot offered to get the war over with. The president greeted, you know, Putin in Alaska at the end of the summer, and there was a big coterie of Russian businessmen along on that trip. And Putin, I know, was hoping to get some business opportunities, at least in the talking phase. So I do understand that Mr. Trump has that in his mind as well. It's a classic diplomatic approach, right? The carrot and the stick.
Right, but I'm just wondering, because I've picked up on that as well. President Trump has consistently talked about the great business and economic opportunities that await the U.S. and Russia once this war ends, and also continues to talk about the fate and the attrition of soldiers in this war, and Russians as well. Every week he throws out a number. These are two points that we don't hear from Vladimir Putin. And I'm just wondering if the president's focus is a bit miscalculated. We know that Russia's economy is facing some hardships, but they can withstand another few years, at least, given where they are now in a wartime footing. He seems to be just fine having Russia isolated where it is, but still remaining close with other BRIC countries in particular. And, you know, the troop attrition, again, seems to be a bigger concern for Trump than Vladimir Putin.
Yes, and that's very odd because I think Vladimir Putin at this moment is playing a dangerous game. You may remember that back in 2022, there was consideration of another big mobilization in Russia, and tens of thousands of Russian men fled the country. And so Putin has been very, very hesitant to try another mobilization. But now they are changing the law, apparently, that limits the use of 2 million reservists. And they've got that before the Russian parliament, which is a rubber stamp. So it looks to me like Putin is considering doing a hidden mobilization, calling it a simple change in the reserve law. And in that case, I think he's showing some vulnerability because that was politically the bridge too far for him back in 2022.
Yeah, we'll see if a play on words will allow this to pass with the Russian people. Remember, for so long, he called this a special military operation. Yes. Before actually identifying it for what it was, and a war. You rightly mentioned that the pressure as of late that President Trump has put on Prime Minister Netanyahu to get to this deal. But one has to note that he essentially allowed the prime minister in Israel to continue not only aggressively on the ground in Gaza, despite the concern and really the isolation of Israel from a number of other countries, but also taking on Iran as well to get to this point. I'm wondering, we've seen pressure that President Trump, especially early in this administration, the first few weeks, put on President Zelensky. Do you think that to get to a ceasefire anywhere near where we saw in Gaza, he should also perhaps start allowing President Zelensky to do a bit more before he then attempts to rein him in, if he does have that oversight over him in a way that he doesn't over Putin?
I really wanted to point to the effectiveness. All the attention is on the Tomahawks at the moment, but Zelensky himself has talked about the effectiveness of two new Ukrainian missiles, two new drones that the Ukrainians have been launching against Russian energy facilities, their gasoline and petroleum producing infrastructure is quite damaged by a series of Ukrainian drone attacks, and now they put their new missiles to use there too. By some accounts, gasoline production is down 20% in Russia, and the Russians have had to import from Belarus in order to be able to supply their drivers with gasoline. So obviously, the Ukrainians have been very good with their own indigenous missiles at causing damage on the Russian side as well. And I can see the president definitely encouraging that kind of activity on the Ukrainian side when he sees Mr. Zelensky on Friday.
Yeah, he does seem to be impressed by military wins. He's said as much with regards to some of the strikes that Ukraine had.
And with that, we have come to the conclusion after this episode of On the Radar News Analysis. To stay tuned now for the Voters Education Program, Voters Preparation Program with Bishop Lucas Katinda. Goodbye.
Listen to Eagle FM in Lodritz at 91.2 FM. Listen to Eagle FM in Omthea at 90.5. Listen to Eagle FM in Mariental at 101.2. Listen to Eagle.